Well, it was a very, very, very interesting week politically. If you follow politics, the whole world changed dramatically in 1 week. And I think it all came down to this. There was a debate recently where Scott Brown and the other candidate were debating, and David Gergen asked the question, "Will you veto this bill when you're sitting in Ted Kennedy's seat?" And Scott Brown said, "Well, with all due respect, it's not the Kennedy seat, and it's not the Democrat seat, it's the people's seat," to which people erupted. It reminds me of the 1988 vice presidential debate where Dan Quayle was debating Lloyd Benson. And Dan Quayle said, "What kind of qualifications does Dan Quayle have to be president? What kind of qualifications do I have? What would I do in this kind of situation? Well, I have far more experience than many others that have sought the office of vice president of this country. I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur." And Judy Woodruff said, "Senator Benson?" And Senator Benson said, "I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy." In 1984, the debate went like this. It was Walter Mondale and Reagan. And remember, Reagan at this point was 73, and Walter Mondale asked him delicately if he was too old. And Reagan said, "Well, not at all. I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I'm not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience." At least they don't live in England, where they get really bitter. One time, the later member of parliament saw Winston Churchill falling asleep during the middle of the debate. And he goes up to Churchill and he says, "Churchill, must you fall asleep when I'm speaking?" To which Churchill replied, "No, it's purely voluntary." Or Lady Astor once asked, she was the first woman elected to Parliament in England and did not get along with Winston Churchill at all. She told Winston Churchill once, "If you were my husband, Winston, I should flavor your coffee with poison." To which Winston Churchill replied, "If I were your husband, madam, I would drink it." Apparently, Churchill didn't have any friends. He once told George Bernard Shaw, the famous playwright, George Bernard Shaw once wrote Churchill and said, "I am enclosing two tickets to the first night of my new play. Bring a friend, if you have one." To which Churchill replied, "I cannot possibly attend the first night. I will attend the second, if there is one." And this is true. This is Churchill. Bessie Braddock was another member of Parliament. She wasn't the first female member, but she once was at a party with Winston Churchill and said, "Winston, you are drunk. And what is more than that, you are disgustingly drunk." To which Churchill said, "Bessie, my dear, you are ugly. And what's more, you are disgustingly ugly. But tomorrow I shall be sober, but you will still be disgustingly ugly." This is the stuff that comedy is made of. You turn on the TV any night to any situation comedy and look, and what is it? It's really a series of insults, carefully timed and perfectly positioned to bring out the worst in another person, isn't it? And every single one of us will go home tonight, and at some point this week we'll turn on a situation comedy and we'll see people insulting each other and we'll say, "Aha, isn't that funny?" And it is funny because it's on TV, right? But what happens if the insult is directed to you? What if somebody says something mean or nasty to you? Does it become funny anymore? Have you ever been in a situation where somebody has just absolutely ripped into you and made you feel horrible, been angry to you, and you go away from that feeling just horrible? You know, relationships are tender. Jesus says that when you are bitter to another person, when you're angry at another person, the way you treat other people, you can actually be committing murder. It's like taking a sword and driving it through their body, and it may not kill them, but if you continue to do it often enough, you might do that. Today we're in the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus is talking about relationships. And you remember last week we talked about God's law, his holy law, his moral law, and how they had set up this barrier around God's moral law. And we're going to talk about that barrier, and we're going to talk about even deeper issues. When we continue on with the Sermon on the Mount, we're going to begin in chapter 5, verse 21, where Jesus says, "You have heard it said to people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment." Now, we know that what Jesus is talking about here isn't necessarily just the written Old Testament, because if it was that, he would have said, "You've heard it, you've seen it written," or "You've seen it written." But what Jesus is talking about, he said, "You've heard it said." He's talking about that barrier of laws, the 613 mitzvot laws, that talked about how we should treat each other when it comes to murder. And they had a whole entire, we heard this morning from the Old Testament about whether or not it was a voluntary murder or if it was an accident, and how they separated that in the Old Testament. But they had a whole range of laws that dealt with murder. And if you followed those laws, you weren't murdering anybody. But Jesus said, "You know what? You think you're not murdering someone just because you don't drive a dagger through their heart. Let me tell you something. Murder is something more than that." And then he lists three things. Beginning in verse 22, he says, "But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment." Anybody who's angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. We talked a few weeks ago about righteous anger and about unrighteous anger and how sometimes we have unrighteous anger in our lives. And we talked about that. But basically, an unrighteous anger is one where your intent is to destroy the other person. Where you get so angry, you're just willing to do anything to destroy or murder. Maybe not take physically a knife and shove it through their heart, but you're going to do everything you can in your power to do something just like it. Jesus says that's wrong. Now, anger is not wrong. We know this. Because some of us get righteously angry all the time. Jesus even got righteously angry. I know that sometimes our children can cause us to be righteously angry. You might have a child that you've told five times to clean the cat litter box. And then you tell him or her the sixth time to clean the cat litter box. And you come in and on the seventh time, the cat litter box is still not cleaned. And you get very, very angry at your child for doing that. Now that's kind of a righteous anger. Because what you're trying to do in your children is to teach them to honor God and to teach them to honor their parents. And so you get angry because you need to get through to them. But an unrighteous anger is where you take somebody and they make you so angry that you have put it as your life's goal, your life's mission to destroy that person. You're going to take and you're going to create a caricature of that person in your mind and you're going to present that character to everybody, and that's what you're going to destroy. Now, we see this all the time in politics, since we're talking about politics. Isn't that what happens? You get a candidate running for office, and what's their job? You know, here's my vision, here are the issues, and then what happens? It goes negative, right? And as soon as it goes negative, well, then they're going to take everything that the other candidate says and they're going to start creating a caricature of that candidate. They're stupid. They're not worthy. They're everything they can possibly do to try to tear down the other character. And that's the image that they make of that, and then they fight against that image. But we know that's not true. They're just creating a caricature. And yes, that's what happens. And we do that in our lives when we get angry. We create a caricature of other people. And we fight against them. And our job, we get so angry, we want to destroy them. When Jesus says, that's murder. You're not supposed to destroy other people. You're supposed to lift them up. You're supposed to put the best construction on it that you possibly can. But Jesus goes further. He says, again, anyone who says to his brother, raka, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. Now, raka is a word that only find in this verse. It's only found once in the New Testament. And it comes from the Aramaic word that means nothingness. And basically what he's saying here is when you say, I wash my hands of you, I have nothing to do with you, you are nothing to me. You know, we have all these people in Haiti right now trying to salvage all this people after the earthquake. And we've got all these children. And yet, after the earthquake has been rescued and they get all the people and they start giving the aid, all those people are going to leave. What about the other children of the world that to us in the United States are raka? We don't even see them. We look through them. We don't even care about them. When you have another human being in this world that is in need or is in sick or hurting or just another human being and you look past them and say, you're not worthy of my time. You know, we do this in relationships all the time. You might have a brother or a sister or a mom or a dad or a kid, and you work with them and you work with them, and finally you get to that point where you say, fine, I've had it. I have nothing more. I wash my hands. To you, to me, you're dead. You know, you've seen that in movies. To me, you're dead. Jesus says, no individual is worthy of that. Every individual is created in the likeness of God. Every individual has worth. That is the worst thing you can do, is to say to somebody, you are nobody. Jesus says, when you do that, it's like another dagger through the heart. But he continues on. He says, therefore, if anyone says you fool, you'll be in danger of the fires of hell. You fool. Now this word fool in Greek is moros. It's the root word of moron. It's one of those few Greek words that you know. But I don't know why they didn't put moron there, because you understand that word. Basically, you know, if you're going to exist with somebody, if you're going to be in a relationship with somebody, you're going to wash your hands, or how do you sometimes deal with relationships? You say, you're a moron. You're stupid. You're an idiot. This act of superiority that you get. Well, at least if I'm going to deal with you, at least I can know that I'm superior to you. You know what I'm saying? We see this all the time in society. We see it in politics. We see it in offices. There's people at your office that you have to deal with all the time, and they get you so upset, but because you have to be in a relationship with that person secretly, it's like, at least I'm better than that person. At least I don't have the sins that that person has. And yet, there are sins in your life that that person doesn't have that you have. All the sins in the world are in the human nature. It's just that we haven't cultivated them yet. So the Christian looks at another person, and what does he see? He sees another child of God, not superior, just different. And that person has sins, but you know what? We have sins too. We see this in workplaces. We see this in families, where a person in a family may say, well, I'm the superior one in the family. At least I've never done anything wrong. To which all the other brothers and sisters, yeah, mom and dad hasn't caught you. They just think that you're perfect. But we know the truth. It happens in schools. I remember when I was a kid in high school, you know, you had all the different groups. You had the cheerleaders and the football players, and they all thought they were superior. And we never thought our group was superior. It was called the Ekniaks. It was science spelled backwards, okay? We were not cool whatsoever, but we were okay. We were cool in our non-coolness. It's okay to be in a different group. The problem is when you think that everybody else is inferior to you and you walk around with your nose up in the air and you call everybody else a moron, call everybody else stupid. When you do that, it's like driving a knife through another person's heart. Relationships are tenuous. Relationships are precious. What Jesus says is that when you are in a relationship with any other human being on this earth, you must treat them with respect and love. And Jesus goes even one point farther. Verse 24, listen to this. Or verse 23, he says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there that you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Jesus said that that relationships are so precious that if you come to the altar of God and you realize that you have something with another person, that you need to go and reconcile with that other person immediately, even before you finish your work at the altar. And does it say this? If your brother, if you sinned at your brother and your brother is angry at you because you sinned, then go. Or does it say go reconcile? You know, a lot of times we feel that reconciliation is just the person who sinned against the other person. That's the one who has to reconcile, right? That if there's a relationship and you hurt me, well, I'm just going to wait until you come and reconcile with me. That's not what the gospel says. That's not what Jesus says. He says relationships are so precious that if you've got a relationship in your life that is not right, no matter who started it, it is your responsibility to go and reconcile with another person. And it is so important, the immediacy of it is so important, that if you were at the altar, you were to leave your gift and go and reconcile. How many people do you know that have relationships in their life they have not reconciled? The reason for the immediacy is because if it lingers and goes on and on, they may never get reconciled, ever. And it doesn't matter who started. I know people who are so angry with somebody, and they will tell you, I have no idea why we started it. It was something, but I can't remember. But I'm never speaking to that person again. Jesus says that is wrong. That's like taking a knife and shoving it through their heart. If you have a relationship with somebody else and you've not reconciled with that person, God is telling you to go and reconcile. Every day that you wait makes it harder and harder. It's difficult relationships. You know, you all say, well, you know, it's easy to say and do, but to actually practice, you know, that's a whole different thing. And no, it is difficult. Reconciling with another person, treating other people with respect, not dissing them. You know, you read about all the disses that happen. Not dissing other people is very difficult, but that's what God calls us to do. Why? Why? Because it's the heart of God. You know, the moral law that we're talking about here, the moral law of God is that he does not do these things. When God gets angry at you, it is a righteous anger, but he is never out to get you. He's never out to destroy you. If God were to destroy you for your sin, you want to know something, folks? You wouldn't be here, because he's all-powerful God. He could destroy you if he wanted to. The reason why God gets angry is to force you to see that you need Jesus as your Savior. God doesn't think you're nothing. You are more precious to God. You know, you're like a grain of sand to God in the vast ocean of life that he's created, and yet he sees you to be the most precious of all his possessions. Everything, all of his love, all of his attention, everything is directed to you. He never says you're nothing. He loves you. He never calls you a fool, ever. He created you in his image, in his likeness. And here's the beautiful part. Any time that you are at a distance from God, you need to be reconciled from God. He is already reconciled with you, because he did the reconciliation 2,000 years ago on the cross when he gave his one and perfect son as a sacrifice to reconcile you to him. And because of that act, you will never, ever be out of favor with God. You are his precious child. Even before you ask forgiveness, he's already forgiven you. That's how wonderful a God we have. Relationships are tough. I know they are. But God, through the power of the Holy Spirit, can work through you to give you the joy and the happiness that comes from wonderful relationships. And you've got the best relationship of all, and that is the relationship you have with your God that thinks you're special, that loves you, always reconciles with you. In his name, amen.